we are born to be kings. We're the princes of the universe. Here we belong. Fighting to survive in a war with the darkest powers.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear to the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week I'm joined once again by Sean Michael Vogt to continue our discussion of Roger Zelazny's epic fantasy saga, The Chronicles of Amber. Sean, welcome back aboard the White Rocket Show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ben. It's good to be back.
Yeah, I had such a great time talking with you a couple of months ago. We've just been, various things have delayed us in getting back to picking this topic up again. But I had a great time talking with you about the first two books. Back in, on episode 68, we discussed very thoroughly Nine Princes in Amber and The Guns of Avalon. And we left it off there. That was kind of like what came in that first volume, if you got it from the science fiction book club, right? You got the yellow book and the green book.
Yes.
And in the yellow book, you had those two. And in the green book, we're going to cover the green book tonight, right? So these are books that were originally published in 1975, 1976, and 1978. So the 70s really were Zelazny's decade to put out all five of his classic original Amber books. And I'm really looking forward to digging into those with you a little bit. And I got a couple of things to say up front. One is that when we spoke about it before a couple of months ago, I had just finished reading, I believe, all five of those, and they were very, very fresh in my mind. Well, it's been a couple of months now, and I have a very poor memory for a lot of things. So hopefully it'll all come back to me as we talk, because I've read a lot of stuff and written a whole other book since then. The other thing is I want to make sure that our listeners out there know that since this is, as I pointed out last time, this is the 20th year, the 20th anniversary of Roger Zelazny's passing away, I requested that Dragon Con do a memorial panel, and the sci-fi literature track was happy to oblige. And so Dragon Con is coming up. I mean, it's immediately coming up. By the time you hear this, it may have already gone by. In fact, I'm going to try to get this episode up as soon as possible. We're recording it on August 30th. Dragon Con begins the following Thursday after the Sunday we're recording this, so I'll have it up immediately. But if you're hearing this in time and you don't know, Saturday, 1 p.m. in the Sci-Fi Literature Track Room, which is the Embassy Room A and B of the Hyatt Regency in Atlanta, we'll be doing a Roger Zelazny sort of memorial panel. We'll talk about his life and his work, not just Amber here like we're doing in our two episodes, but basically everything we can think of. We'll have questions from the audience, and it should be a really nice little event. So hopefully I'll see a few of you folks out there at Dragon Con and at the Roger Zelazny Memorial. Now, Sean, we're going to jump on into Sign of the Unicorn. So I don't remember exactly how we approached it last time, but how would you say, because you're probably more prepared than I am, I'm afraid, how should we approach Sign of the Unicorn? What comes to your mind first about that?
Well, I actually just sped read through all three of them.
All right.
I just finished right before you called me.
Excellent.
But I've got the book right here because I mentioned to you earlier that I had just picked up the Great Book of Amber,
mm-hmm.
which has, you know, everything in it.
All 10.
Yeah. It's got the Corwin and the Merlin series. So, mm-hmm. Where to start? Corwin, this starts rather abruptly. He has a bit of a problem, to put it lightly. And I really consider this book, and I know we kind of talked about it before about similarities, but this is, yes, it's sci-fi fantasy, but there's also a very large influence as far as mystery goes.
Yes. Yes.
And these next three books are where, you know, starting with Sign of the Unicorn is where you really start getting into the meat of things. And Corwin and the reader start finding out some of the answers that were to the questions that were posed in the first two books.
Would you say it's fair that to say that there's really in the first five in the Corwin Chronicles, there's really two separate stories. Now, they do interlace. Mm-hmm. But the first story is Corwin versus Eric, and it ends in somewhat anticlimactic ways, right, at the end of the second book. So now with 3, 4, and 5, we really get into a completely different story because at the beginning of Sign of the Unicorn, and let me just warn folks, if you haven't read these, there's going to be spoilers, okay? We're going to talk about the details just like we did before. But I mean, I think it's fair to say that when you start the third book, Corwin has almost everything he wanted to achieve in the first two books. And what he's discovering is that maybe it's not as much fun to have those things as he thought, particularly when your relatives hate you pretty much as all of his relatives hate each other.
Yes. I mean, the first two are basically him just, you know, like you said, against Eric, his most hated sibling,
mm-hmm.
and also about finding out who he is, basically. And in mm-hmm. the ending, it comes full circle, and he has his kind of, I guess, Pyrrhic victory over Eric, because, like you said, it doesn't really end the way he imagined it.
Right.
And he's almost fully back to himself. And he's kind of handed the kingdom and everything he wants, like on, you know, just it's been handed to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's slowly realizing, like you said, that what he always thought he wanted possibly isn't really what he actually wants.
Yeah.
And these next three books, you know, that that theme's explored a little more about, mm-hmm. you know, how things don't always turn out the way, you know, you think they will, basically.
Yeah, he's sort of built up in his mind that if he can be ruler of Amber, everything else will just be fine and take care of itself. And he finds himself not really ruler of Amber, but sort of in a position of supreme advantage toward that end, shall we say. And he realizes everything's not going to go back to being all good and happy and light just because he's in that position. And in fact, people are quite willing to blame him for things that happen, even if it's not his fault, you know, which is the true of any ruler.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, cause at the very, like you said, at the very beginning, things kind of start hopping immediately when he finds the body and he finds a body of one of his siblings, or so he believes. And it's kind of funny. Tell me what you thought about this. Zelazny drove me crazy because this happens twice. There's a scene where his buddy, all he knows at this point is his buddy Ganelon. There's a scene where his buddy Ganelon finds some dead bodies and disposes of them in such a way that makes him look guilty, even though he's just trying to avoid all the entanglements if he were to be accused because he's not guilty. And the same thing happens here. Corwin finds a body. And he knows that everybody's going to think he did it and is going to blame him whether he did it or not. And so he has to kind of deal with that. So it's extremely frustrating to be a reader and be rooting for Corwin and see him put in this situation where he kind of has to almost look guilty in order to stay viable in what he's trying to do. Does that make sense at all?
No, I understand what you're saying perfectly. I feel pretty much the same way about it, but the thing is, you know, as you said, the royal family, the family of Amber, is very Machiavellian.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, they distrust each other, you know, entirely. They're not like a normal family.
Right.
And it doesn't really matter what Corwin does. They're going to believe, you know, based on their own agendas, what they want to believe regardless. Mm-hmm. If they support Corwin like Random does, you know, they're going to believe Corwin. If they hate him like Julian does, then they're going to hate him and believe that he did. And the only ones that are kind of apart from this, that are more, I don't know, they can step back and take a more logical look, and they're not really on either side, or probably in my mind, like Benedict and Gerard. But mm-hmm. the thing is, Benedict has already been poisoned against him because of the prior bodies you mentioned. So
yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking when you said that, is I immediately thought, well, you're exactly right that Benedict is the most mature, the most considering, you know, of all of them, the most neutral. But yet immediately things happen that even make Benedict totally distrust Corwin. And that's the sign of one of the signs of a good writer is that he can take your hero and put him or her in a position where it's frustrating to the reader because you don't want to see your hero suffer, and certainly not unjustly. But that's part of telling a story, you know, is to put them in a bad position and then make it worse so they can impress you by getting out of it eventually. And they do. But yeah, it's extremely, Corwin ends up in just basically everybody's doghouse throughout these last three books, including his father. So, I don't want to go through every chapter, but there's a couple of other things I do want to point out in Sign of the Unicorn. The second chapter is possibly the most unusual chapter in all five books. Do you remember what it is that's so different about the second chapter of Sign of the Unicorn?
I'm actually kind of looking at it right this minute.
It threw me off when I was a teenager the first time I read it because I didn't catch what was happening. And it really confused me. I had to go back and reread it, understanding what was going on. The second chapter of Sign of the Unicorn is the only part of any of the books that is told from a different character's point of view.
Oh, yes, yes. Now I'm getting what you're saying. It's Random recounting this one journey that is very important to Corwin right now. And he's finally getting back to giving details that, you know, Corwin wanted to know him much earlier, but
yeah.
We're finally getting around to getting the details now in book three.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, a couple of things about that, because I'm glad you said that about what he's talking about. That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it threw me off just because Zelazny is very subtle in his transition there. You get to the end of chapter one, and Random is there talking to Corwin, and then you turn the page and you're in chapter two, and it's still in first person, so you just assume it's still Corwin talking. And suddenly over the space of a page or two, you realize, wait a minute, Corwin doesn't play the drums. Corwin doesn't go hang gliding, you know, or whatever, gliding in a glider. And then you go, oh, it's Random talking. But see, because he had never used that, he had never changed the perspective that we're hearing the story from through two whole books before this and then another chapter, it kind of blindsides you a little bit. At least it did me the first time. So, but yeah, what they're talking about is, you remember back at the beginning almost of the first book, these big, we talked about this last time, these big sort of alien looking guys with hooks or pointy spiky things in their hands were chasing Random through Shadow. And that's how he ended up arriving at Flora's mansion and teaming up with Corwin. And then that kind of got dropped for two whole books because there just never really was it would have been a weird thing in the first two books to just stop the entire story so that Random can tell, oh, here's what happened with here's where these guys came from. But because that needed eventually to be told, Zelazny just sort of takes the second chapter of this book before things really get going again, and he lets Random explain the whole thing, which is going to tie us in with, I believe, Brand, right?
Yes.
So he's basically how he came into contact with Brand, who's been missing for a while.
Yeah, and who becomes a little more central to everything, you know, as this goes on. But
yeah,
I mean, that the first two books were very lean, and you know, they were quick moving. So mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. There wasn't really a spot in there to stick this, mm-hmm. where you know that wouldn't be out of place. But as I said earlier, there's a lot of exposition and a lot of answers to previous questions that come out in these next three. So
yeah,
you know, he kind of gets right to it. He explains the situation that Corwin is now in, and then he gets the ball rolling about seeking these answers. And yeah. Random starts out with telling him about how he came across their long lost brother.
Right, right. You know, I got to say up front too that I've read these books, all five of them, probably 8 or 9 times now over the years, going back to high school, and the last three still completely run together in my mind. I mean, for about a week after I read them, I completely know what happens in each book and where each one ends and the next begins. But honestly, after about a week, the number 3, 4, and 5 just seem like one big book. Is it kind of that way to you too?
Oh, yes. It seems like, you know, more of like, say, very long chapters of a bigger work, you know. And I'm kind of, like I said, I sped read through them, you know, right before this. And they're already kind of starting to blur together to where I'm not quite sure where one ended off and where one starts.
Yeah. The and Courts of Chaos is short.
Yes.
It's one of the shortest novels I've ever read in my life. Yeah, it really is. So I'm trying to look back. Okay. So Sign of the Unicorn, like you say, it has a good bit of exposition compared to the first two books. It also, one of the things it's kind of like, if you're into this story, you like this. And if you're not entirely sure you're into this story when you get to this book, my gosh, if you get this book, you better be in it. You're number three. It's off-putting, which is that there's a lot of conversations and a lot of moving the pieces around the board in this book. And so it's not just, it's not as fast-paced in a lot of the way as the first two. But it also brings in a lot of characters that maybe we only saw a glimpse of in the first two books. They actually get more chances to do stuff. I think you get more Gerard, you get more Julian. You certainly are coming up on at some point getting more Fiona. That may be a little bit later on. You know, in other words, he's back in Amber now instead of on Earth most of the time. And so he actually gets to interact more with his relatives that you just haven't seen much of prior to this book.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as I was reading through, that this is where you actually get to meet and know the actual, you know, character of the various siblings, like who they really are. Because up to now, you've, other than the couple encounters with Eric and then the bit of time with Blaze and Flora, and of course Random's been around, but these other characters that you've heard about and kind of every once in a while there's an interaction, you get to know a lot more about them. And you're not just going on these kind of dated recollections of
right. Poets. Yeah. Oh, and Benedict. You get a lot more of Benedict in the last three because you hardly even saw him at all. He was talked about in hushed tones, like, oh, if Benedict was here, you know, it'd all be settled. He'd just come in and straighten everything out. But then he finally shows up. And I thought that was very effective, too, because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Sign of the Unicorn is the one where Corwin meets Dara, and she says she's Benedict's granddaughter, I believe. And Benedict ends up chasing Corwin halfway across the universe on horseback, right? Isn't that in this? I think it is.
No, that's in Guns of Avalon, actually.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
I forgot about that.
Yeah, you got to see what Benedict wasn't in it nearly as much as you'd think, since a lot of it took place in Avalon, which is his kingdom.
That's right. That's right.
But he was off facing those chaos forces. In battle. So that's one of the reasons he kind of just basically stuck around, greeted Corwin, told him, you have the run of the city, and now I got to go fight some stuff.
Yeah, I told you it runs together in my head, and there you go. There's a good example. Well, so, yeah, so I'm trying to think, what's the main thing that happens in Sign of the Unicorn that kind of advances things forward? I know that at the end, I'll go ahead and mention at the, cause, you know, at the end, we get the big, reveal that the pattern in amber is not the pattern. It's just the first reflection or the first shadow, right?
Yeah, that's at the very end where him and Ganelon kind of figure it out.
They go to the primal pattern, which I guess
they're led there by the unicorn, and it's pretty much all a plan of someone's. I'm not going to say who yet, but
so is this the one where there's the fist fight between Corwin and Gerard?
Yes, it is. And it's also the one where they bring Brand back, that they managed to bring him back through the Trumps. And then he ends up getting stabbed in the back by somebody that has to be one of them. So as they say, the plot thickens.
Yeah. So a whole lot of stuff happens in Castle Amber. A lot more stuff happens in Castle Amber, it seems like, than did in the first two books. Unless you count the dungeon cell, you know, that Corwin is in. But other than that, like actually doing political and family business inside the castle, there's a lot of that in this book. And so I guess this is the one where Corwin gets stabbed and ends up waking up in his old house on Earth, right?
I believe, yes. I think that happens towards the end. Check real quick.
Yeah, yeah. I just happened to flip open randomly, and he says, out of every life, a little blood must spill. Unfortunately, it was my turn again. I was lying doubled up on my side. Yeah. So
that's where he doesn't really put it together until later, I think, but he gets some information later on about the jewel.
Yeah.
That it will move to protect its wearer, you know, from harm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what kind of transported him from his bed to his old house.
Yeah, the Jewel of Judgment becomes very important starting now, because Eric had been using it just purely as a weapon, as a weather control weapon against the forces of chaos at the very end of the Guns of Avalon before he died. In fact, he didn't fully know what he was doing, and you could make the argument that the Jewel of Judgment was as responsible for Eric dying as anything, right? Because it kind of sucked his life force out. And go ahead.
Yeah, I believe it was Fiona was the one that put that force, since her and Blaze and Brand, they all know. It turns out they know a lot more about the pattern and the workings behind it than the other siblings. And she's the one that chooses to mention to Corwin, I believe, that, you know, it does suck energy out of you, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of power it, I guess. And also that there's a time dilation effect when you've been using it too long, that it speeds your metabolism up to the point, and which causes your body to break down even faster.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's something you can do that this is what Eric didn't know, is you can picture the pattern and channel the energy from the pattern into the jewel, and that way you're just kind of the conduit instead of the battery. And Eric didn't know you could do that, and so he just became the battery until he ran dry, basically. And he was wounded, and it just made his wounds that much worse. So, all right, so that's pretty much Sign of the Unicorn, and at the end of that book, Corwin and Ganelon are cooperating and trying to figure out, you know, what's all going on and what they need to do to avert this growing threat from chaos, the Black Road, and all that. Plus, they've reintroduced Brand, and so we're getting to know him as a character really for the first time. Also, I believe it's somewhere along the line, Random is off in, he's still being held prisoner in Rebma, right? And then he's and I want to say his wife Vial, who is blind, she ends up in Amber, doesn't she? I mean, I'm trying to think how that.
Well, towards the beginning of the, or is it at the end of the Guns? Okay, no, it's at the end of the Guns of Avalon. Mm-hmm. He when Corwin is chasing Dara and trying to prevent her from getting to the pattern.
Yeah.
That's when he first meets Random and they, you know, link back up and he kind of brings him up to speed that Eric's dead. And what it's been was that Random was being held captive in Amber because he walked the pattern and tried to assassinate Eric.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
And Vial actually, she petitioned to join her husband, you know, in
prison, basically.
So basically, but it's that Eric didn't know how to react. So it's not the dungeons that Corwin was in. They have their own suite. They're basically under house arrest, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, they're already in Amber. But because that was at the end of the Guns of Avalon, and I think we don't actually get to meet Vial until the Hand of Oberon.
Okay.
I think that's when we actually get a meeting between her and Corwin, and she says some things that makes him really take a look at himself and his motivations. So she is a pivotal character.
She really is, yeah, and we'll get to that in just a minute, I guess, because that's very important. There's one other, I guess, there's probably some more, and it may have occurred to us. We're just kind of hopping around here, and that's mostly my fault because it's just not totally clear in my memory anymore. But there's another set piece scene in The Sign of the Unicorn I don't want to skip before we leave it, which is Corwin decides to visit Tirna Nokth. I guess I'm pronouncing that right. And that is, how would you describe Tirna Nokth?
It actually reminds me of, like, you know, kind of ghost castle. It's fairy magic. I don't know what to say, really. Mm. It's a spectral kind of companion of Amber, and it appears in the sky. And if I remember right, when the full moon is out,
yeah,
it becomes solid at certain times, and yeah, you can actually walk around and you're given these visions. The things happen in there. Some of them are prophetic. Some of them not so much. You know, it's left up to whoever's walking and seeing the visions to separate the truth from, you know, the fiction.
Yeah, and that's really neat, isn't it? I just think it's a cool idea.
Yeah, I liked it. I like the fact that they have that, and then they have also the counterpart of Amber under the sea. And, you know, he throws out a lot of really cool things that beyond just Amber, you know.
Yeah, it's neat. There's the primal pattern. There's Rebma, the underwater version. There's Amber itself. And then there's Tirna Nokth up in the clouds. It makes you wonder if there are other versions that he might have gotten to eventually if he'd kept going, because he was certainly not reluctant to add new stuff whenever he thought of it. You know, he added new siblings constantly. There were, you know, if you read the Merlin Five books, there's several more siblings that pop up that you wouldn't ever have known were out there. So he likes to add, stuff, but, it is neat that there's all those different levels. So yeah, Corwin goes up there. And there this is so funny. I love sort of time loop stuff. I've always been a big fan of time loop stuff. So Corwin goes up there, and while the moon is out, and he's very smart, by the way, he has a trump, and he has, I guess, Random or somebody standing down there on the ground to trump him out if he's going to start falling through the floor. Because if the moon gets covered up by the clouds or the moon sets, Tirna Nokth goes away and you just fall into the ocean from way up in the air. You don't want that. So, but he goes up there and he sees, I believe, Benedict with a metal hand, right? A metal arm, like a steampunk arm, right?
What he sees first off is, Dara, and mm-hmm, she's sitting on the throne of Amber, and next to her is Benedict, and he does have that prosthetic metal, arm, since I don't remember if we mentioned in the previous episode, but his hand has been lopped off fighting these chaos things.
Yeah, not by Corwin. It was lopped off by the chaos creatures, yeah.
Yes. Well, now he has this, you know, basically fancy metal hand that's, and they, of course, they're both specters to each other. Mm-hmm. Like, they can't see Corwin, what he does is he walks up and he touches Dara with Graceweather, his sword, and that allows them to, you know, interact with him. And this is where we find out like another kind of little, some information that pretty much spells out that Dara is not lying about her ancestry. Right. She's been claiming to be descended from Benedict. Mm-hmm. And, this is somewhere in the future where all all the other princes and princesses have been destroyed, and Dara and the forces of chaos have taken over Amber, and she's Queen Dara. And Benedict has come over to her side as her, I think, what was it? Great, great, great grandfather, something along those lines. Yeah,
it keeps changing all the way through as the stories change. So it's hard to remember exactly what they finally decided the truth was, but it does seem like there were a lot more generations removed between Benedict and Dara than Dara was originally letting on.
Yeah. At first he was saying she was saying that she was his illegitimate granddaughter or something along those lines. But, being from the other end of the spectrum, on the chaos side, Dara is who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Time runs a lot quicker than it does at this end of the spectrum. So many generations have passed since that first daughter. And like, there's a lot of greats thrown in there. Great, 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 great.
Right.
Whatever.
Right. Okay. So to kind of sum up Sign of the Unicorn, it's a transitional book, right? It's the middle book. It gets you out of the Eric versus Corwin sort of dichotomous struggle there, and introduces more characters or fleshes out more characters, introduces the bigger situation, which involves Brand, which involves Chaos, the Black Road, keeps Ganelon involved, and has Corwin now in a position of advantage. So there's a lot to like about it. It's not much of a self-contained book. You couldn't really read The Sign of the Unicorn by itself and get a lot out of it other than just some really cool writing and some really cool scenes, but it's very much the middle installation. So now let's kind of roll on into – if we need to go back to anything, we certainly can, but let's roll on into The Hand of Oberon. A lot of interesting things happen in this book. They start out discovering that there's a primal pattern, of course, at the end of the previous book, and they realize sort of over time they figured this out that it's been damaged, right? I mean, that's sort of the MacGuffin that gets the last two books going, is that the primal pattern itself has been damaged, which has kind of damaged all of the multiverse and opened a doorway to chaos to come in and take over the multiverse. And what that is, in other words, for the listeners that don't know exactly what I'm talking about, or those that have kind of forgotten, it's kind of like Amber is one end of the multiverse and chaos is the other. I mean, really, Amber is order. Mm-hmm. And so you have order and chaos. You have Amber and chaos. And in between are all the myriad multiverse universe probabilities. That's the shadow that the Amberites can walk through. And what has happened is that something has damaged the primal pattern in such a way by putting a stain of blood on it that it's opened up the Black Road as a tunnel that goes from chaos right through shadow to amber. And that's how chaos has been assaulting Amber. Now, Corwin first thinks it's happened because of him, that it was his curse that did it.
Curse.
And his curse didn't help, but it really turns out that it's part of a bigger plot. Really, I'm going to say it involves Brand. Because Bran has gotten involved with things that are bigger than he probably thought they would be, and bigger than he can really control. And he really turns out to be kind of the villain of the entire five-book series. You just don't know it for three and a half books, basically. But to kind of get the introduction out of the way, the thing I wanted to point out that Corwin ends up talking to Dworkin, who may be their grandfather. He may be Oberon's father. I mean, I know that the books that Betancourt does later explicitly say that Dworkin is Oberon's father, but I'm not entirely sure that that's absolutely confirmed in the actual Zelazny books.
There actually is a part in there where Dworkin's talking, where he does confirm that both him and then Dara when they're questioning her, and I believe it's in the courts about mid book.
Okay.
They both kind of confirm it.
Okay.
But I don't think anybody is aware of it other than because he doesn't share secrets lately.
Right.
I think the only ones aware of it are Corwin, Oberon himself, and then possibly Blaze, Fiona, and Bran.
The redheads.
I don't think anybody else is much aware of who Dworkin actually is.
And he's the one, by the way, that painted all the trumps. He's the mad artist. And we find out why he's mad, too, insane, is because he is so closely tied into the pattern, into the primal pattern, that when the pattern itself was damaged by the blood of an Amberite, that damaged his mind also. And two things. One is, of course, the blood turns out to be Random's son, Martin, I believe.
Yes, it's
which,
Martin.
Which sets up a whole new character we have to go off and chase. But also, Corwin goes and talks to Dworkin, but Dworkin starts to go crazy and attack him. And this is one of my favorite moments in the entire series. In order to escape, Corwin picks up a random trump that Dworkin has painted. And it's a landscape. It's not a person. So it's basically just like a doorway into another world. And so Corwin picks it up and steps through. And do you remember where he comes out?
Oh, yes. He comes out at the Courts of Chaos.
Yeah.
He actually he encounters someone that's very important to him.
Yes, he does.
But he has no idea who it is at the time. But.
I'm trying to think now because he ends up going back there again later. So when he goes there the first time, he kills somebody, doesn't he?
Well, when he goes there the first time, he's just basically kind of looking around trying to figure out where he's at. And this being that's kind of riding on the air charges him and attacks him. And at the last minute, the being sees his sword and realizes who he is and tries to run away and gets killed anyways.
That happens several times, by the way, in these books, is where the people underestimate Corwin. That's always fun.
Yeah, it's always fun when they finally realize, if not exactly who they're facing, they suddenly realize, oh, this is a Prince of Amber.
Yeah.
And they pretty much try to run away because they realize what kind of situation they've gotten into.
That's the truth. So who's the other person he encounters then? Somebody comes up with a crossbow, right?
Yes, he comes up with a crossbow, and Corwin's standing there and has basically nothing really to defend himself with.
He's squirming around trying to make himself a narrow target.
More thinner.
I just thought that was hilarious that this guy comes up, and Corwin, who's such a badass and has been dealing with monsters and everything, and now he's trying to dodge a crossbow bolt by being skinny. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get shot at, but he thinks he's going to get shot at. Continue. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I understand. It's a funny image. But this guy that comes up on him, he approaches with his crossbow, but then he seems to recognize him. And he asks him, is your name Corwin? Or you know what? No, he doesn't ask that. He asks, is that the blade named Graceswander?
Yeah.
Recognizes the sword. And when Corwin says yes, the man asks him, well, what is your business here? What do you want? And he says, I wish simply to depart. So he discharges his crossbow and tells him to, go about yourself. This place is dangerous for you. Mm-hmm. And Corwin responds that, I won't forget this and I won't forget you. And other guy says, make sure that you don't. And then he rides away. And it turns out that this guy is named Merlin.
Yes.
Kind of important to Corwin. I don't know if you want to go ahead and go into that.
Well, if you're listening to this, we've already said that the second five books are the Merlin cycle as opposed to the Corwin cycle. So, giant spoiler, woot, woot, woot. Merlin is Corwin's son by way of Dara. And I'm sure we talked about this on the last episode, that when Merlin and Dara encountered each other, they had some fun and messed around a bit. And so, sure enough, because time goes faster in the courts. That's why we probably needed to have said that a little bit earlier, that, Dara was saying that she was Benedict's granddaughter, and the reason she could actually be his great-great-great-great-whatever granddaughter is because time travels so much faster. Time moves so much faster at the quartz end of the universe that she had, you know, that much time could have passed there that she could have been the great, 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 great granddaughter. So it's the same thing here. Darrow goes back to the Courts of Chaos, gives birth to Merlin, and he grows up and becomes a young man who can ride a horse and shoot a crossbow and whatever, all within the space of the story still happening in Amber. The same, you know, same moments, the same events. So, one other scene I wanted to mention, by the way, that happened right before that that I missed was that Corwin goes down to his old cell to that's how he ends up back with Dworkin, I believe, and in the dungeons in Amber, and he meets Roger.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that. I was going to wonder that. Mm. I was wondering if you had noticed that as well.
Yeah, I missed it at first, but I'm glad I caught it. Yeah.
He talks about when he's asked how's your day going, that he's working on a romantic piece shot through with some grim doings and
elements of horror and morbidity.
there we go. And he works on them down when he's on dungeon duty.
Yeah.
I really like that. And he was smoking his pipe, of course.
Yeah. I love it because obviously it's Roger Zelazny, and he encounters, so he put himself into the story. And that's fine. I mean, it's kind of like Alfred Hitchcock, you know, putting himself at the beginning of his movies, or like seeing Stan Lee and all the Marvel movies. You actually see Roger down there writing a book, and he says something like, what's new? He says, a rat, a bat, you know, nothing much. It's pretty dark. But I just love the idea that, in fact, I wish I had thought about that when I was writing Baranac. I'm going to mention this a couple of times, but I got to say this now because folks that listen to this show, I think most of them know me and know that I write a lot of books, and B, they're very inspired by Roger Zelazny. And I've got to tell y'all now, and I'll mention again at the end, that my most recent novel, Baranac, was so inspired by what we're going to talk about from the Courts of Chaos. There's just a lot of Courts of Chaos DNA inside the Baranac novel, Baranac Storming the Gates. And I wish now that I had included, I didn't do it, but I almost wish that he had encountered somebody named Van. But that would be a little too on the nose, wouldn't it?
No, that would have been pretty cool since I do have that book. I haven't gotten around to reading it yet, but it would have been along the lines of coming across the Roger on guard down in the dungeons.
There's probably enough parallels that I didn't need to put one just that 100%, but that would have been funny. So, all right. So those two things happen. He discovers the, he goes to Chaos. I believe at this point they've realized maybe that, it was Martin. Yeah. They find the card with the dagger through it.
Trump. And then he asks, when he meets Dworkin, he asks him specifically who drew it.
Mm-hmm.
And he confirms that it's our kind of big bad Brand that did it.
And there's a little clue that's dropped in here I want to talk to you here as a brief aside. Okay. I think the audience will enjoy this because this is a topic that I think fans of this series like to talk about, I suspect.
Okay.
I think that once this book starts, and maybe toward the end of the previous one, I think Zelazny has made a decision about a certain character that I honestly don't think he had made the decision of prior. Now, I want to see what you think about that. But here's what I mean. He suddenly starts dropping in very overt hints that one character is more than he seems. And the hint I'm talking about here is, I believe, while Corwin is standing on the edge of the pattern going, hey, I wonder what that thing is out there. I wonder how we could get it. I have no idea how we could get it. It's awfully dangerous for somebody as powerful as me, a Prince of Amber, to get anywhere near the mm-hmm. the pattern. And then mm-hmm. Ganelon, who is allegedly a human, just runs out on the pattern, picks it up, and runs back off, right?
Yep.
That's a big freaking clue.
And there's other clues in that same around that same scene because Ganelon all of a sudden starts coming up with ideas.
Yeah,
kind of. If not overtly, he drops some little hints that lead them to this new information that they've been brainstorming on.
Yeah,
and there's the part with the You remember the giant purple griffin, of course.
Wixer.
Wixer, there you go. And
hello, Wixer.
Corwin, led by Ganelon, Corwin kind of, well, maybe he's only set here to keep other people off, not Amberites, and he tries the whole nicking his hand and doing all that stuff. Mm-hmm. No, that comes later. Excuse me. He goes up and he starts petting and making friends with the Wixer, and then Random does it, but Ganelon refuses. He comes up with an excuse to refuse it and mm-hmm. kind of thinking, that's a little odd.
Yeah, there's other things too, like you hit the nail on the head when you said that he comes up with ideas. There's at least two and probably more occasions where like Random and Corwin and maybe somebody else are standing around saying, well, I don't know what we should do about this. I don't know. And Ganelon's like, hey, you could do this, this, and this. And they look at him like, who are you and where did you come up with that? And he always comes up with some excuse like, well, I've been paying attention and I don't know. I just get these crazy ideas sometimes. I don't know if this really would work or not, but, you know. So,
well, there's also even more overt, I think later on in Hand near the end,
mm-hmm.
where Ganelon basically pounds the heck out of Gerard.
Gerard, who is just...
Totally takes him down like with ease.
And then he's like, oh, I work out or something.
Oh, he's kind of like, well, maybe next time I won't be so lucky in a rematch. And, you know, you better get going. And you know, if you're not getting the hints at that point, then you're not really paying attention.
It's so funny.
Because we had a previous scene where you mentioned earlier where Gerard just basically takes Corwin apart.
Just to make a point. You know, yeah.
Yes, and we all know how that Corwin's, you know, a pretty bad guy.
Yeah, so. That's exactly right. I mean, that's so funny. Yeah, it's the parallel is great because we see Gerard just beat Corwin down, and then he's like, "Don't forget that I can do this anytime I like." So you better be honest. You know, you better not be up to something because Gerard basically admits, "I'm not the brightest Amberite." Okay, so if you try your tricky things on me, they could work. So basically, I'm just going to ignore you, but I'm going to give you a butt whooping just so you remember what happens if I do figure it out that you're messing with me, you know? Yeah. And then Ganelon just takes him down. And like I said, again, Ganelon just comes up with excuses. Now here's the question I have for you. And this is kind of one of the main questions I've been waiting to ask you. Do you think that Zelazny planned from the beginning that Ganelon would be who he is? We still haven't said it out loud, I don't think. Again, we're just throwing the spoilers out there, so we're going to reveal it in a second. I'm just teasing it a little bit here, but do you think that Zelazny planned from the beginning, or did he make it up and have to sort of retrofit it as the books were going on? And we're going to leave it hanging there for the end of this episode. We'll be back with part two, looking at the Hand of Oberon and the Courts of Chaos very soon, and we'll find out Sean's answer to that question, and we'll talk about the last two books and kind of look back at the first five books, the Corwin Cycle, and what we thought about them overall and their place in fantasy and science fiction history overall. So the Rocket's going to get on out of here for this week. Join us very soon for part two, and we will see you all down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.